Welcome to Winning the Challenger Sale, a podcast where we take you beyond the groundbreaking book that transformed the world of sales and share practical advice on how to show up like a challenger in your customer conversations. I'm your host, Jen Allen. Our goal here is simple: equip you and your teams to win more deals by harnessing your inner challenger. This is part of Challenger Inc.'s suite of products designed to give you everything you need to go from idea to action to meeting and exceeding your sales goals. Now let's get started. Welcome back to this week's episode of Winning the Challenger Sale. I'm your host, Jen Allen, and our theme for this month is opportunity prioritization. Now, this is our second episode this month on how to prioritize the right opportunities and get comfortable disqualifying the wrong ones early and often. Now, I'm very excited to welcome a very special guest this week, Jonathan Bald. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks, Jen. Pleasure being on the show with you today.
Yeah, so excited to have you here. Now, the story behind Jonathan coming on is actually an interesting one. So Jonathan's the area VP of large enterprise sales for RSA Securities NetWitness business in the Canada and East region. And Jonathan reached out to me on LinkedIn and said, "Hey, Jen, been listening to the podcast. I've gone through Challenger a couple times. I'd be super interested in coming on the podcast." Now, full stop, we get a lot of these messages, right? A lot of people want to come on the show. But what caught my eye about Jonathan is he led with perspective, right? He said to me, "There's a couple topics I'm really passionate about. Would you be open to just talking through those to see if I might make a good guest?" He didn't push me. He didn't tell me he was the right guest. He gave me an opportunity to learn more about Jonathan. And he won me at that, right? When I got on the phone with Jonathan and learned more about his journey around Challenger, I think it was 2 minutes into the conversation, I was absolutely sold that he'd make a phenomenal guest. So I'm so delighted to have you here today to pick your brain about your experience picking the right opportunities and disqualifying the wrong ones.
Yeah, that's great, Jen. I mean, Challenger's had such an influence on today's modern way of selling. And for me personally, it's been a part of my sales journey as both an individual contributor, an overlay subject matter expert, and also in the leadership space. That just, it seemed just natural for me to want to obviously align with you guys externally and talk about some of these fundamental concepts and how sales professionals in the market can hone their skills.
Love it. So we are going to hear directly from someone who has gone through Challenger. We're going to learn all about his story, but essentially, I think it's really important to start with, what is that origin story? So how'd you find yourself in sales? How'd you get to where you are today?
So professionally, since I graduated from university, I've been in a direct sales role my entire career. So starting off as an individual contributor, selling in the SMB space for Xerox, 100% commission, we cold called in person and moving up the ladder. So moving into the mid-market space, then small enterprise, and then ultimately the global Fortune 1000. And during that time, I held traditional individual field sales roles, and then moved into overlay specialist roles where I supported a group of account execs as the subject matter expert, and then finally into frontline leadership positions across multiple geographies. So ultimately, Challenger along the way, I originally read the book in 2014, but didn't formally take any Challenger training until 3 or 4 years later. And then now I've been through it, you know, several times. But sales has been a part of my DNA back when I was a kid, even before graduating. I did everything from importing golf shirts from China and selling them at flea markets to running a landscaping business with 10 to 15 clients. So sales has always been sort of at the forefront of my personal and professional life. So that's where I ended up driving, developing my career.
I think you're the first person we've had on that truly, like at a younger age, was like, sales is in my blood. It's such a rare thing. And when I listen to your kind of like story across all the things you've done, it's so fascinating to me because you've played so many different roles. Many times we pick a lane, we stick in that lane, and maybe we go out a little bit and then we come back in. But I think one of the reasons I'm so excited for people to hear your perspective is you've done transactional, you've done door to door, you've done large enterprise, small, medium. And so I think where I'm really, really interested for our listeners to hear from you is what you've learned along the way. So let's get right into that. As we talked about, this month's topic is opportunity prioritization. Now, when you reached out to me, you said, "My opinion, is that the best sales professionals qualify and disqualify with precision. So tell me, what do you mean by that? And what caused you to believe this?
So I'm going to, for the discussion today and for your listeners, I'm going to try to bring together the experience across a decade plus in these various sales roles and distill it down into a heavy hitting 25-minute discussion with you, Jen.
Love it.
And so I really tried to reflect on all these different positions and all these different learnings. And I think I boiled it down into sort of three general themes, right? So you have, number one, you have sales methodologies and philosophies, right? So both internal and external tools to help you qualify and prioritize opportunities. Some are external facing, some are internal, right? Then there's situational factors. So that can influence how you qualify and prioritize opportunities. And I'm talking about, like, you have to qualify the customer and the customer is qualifying you. Your companies have to be a fit. So that's one thing. Then you talk about company maturity. Like, where are you as an organization in terms of your maturity curve? Are you a startup? Are you a mid-sized organization? Or are you an established tech behemoth? That will also determine how you qualify and prioritize your opportunities. And then lastly, we've all heard the term always be closing, but you can't close a deal that's not qualified. So it's really always be qualifying. Always be qualifying and disqualifying opportunities, because that's really what's going to set you up for success to make sure you're maximizing your time in the field. You know, what I find now as a sales leader, I get to witness, coach, and mentor a lot of different sales strategies and sales styles in the field. And the underlying theme I see across all successful reps is not only are they relentless closers, but they're relentless disqualifiers. So they do not want to waste their time on opportunities that aren't a good fit for them, for the company, for the product, or for the customer at the end of the day. And that's really a hard thing to refine, especially earlier on in your career, when you just want to chase all the balls. You just don't know which one to go after, but you're willing and driven to take on any and all opportunities. And that's when you can get burned out.
Oh my gosh, 100%. That's one lesson I wish I had learned much quicker in sales, is not everybody who raises their hand is actually the right person to spend our time with. But I think, especially for those of us that are newer in sales, I think there's a tendency to say, if I'm working, I can feel good about what I'm doing. And what I'm hearing you say is that's absolutely not the right mindset.
And again, pulling that back, of course, what you said is right, Jen. You want to be very surgical with where you're spending your time. As a sales professional, time's your most valuable resource. But it also depends on where you are in terms of your company and product. And I'll just peel that back a bit. Like, when you're a startup, the logo of net new customers is more valuable than the project or the profitability of the project itself. So you're basically just going out there, you're buying any business that you can gain on your product, so that then you can then put those logos on your website and have actual projects to highlight as case studies with other customers to then fuel your revenue engine. So a startup looking to land their first few deals is going to qualify and disqualify very differently than a well-established product in the market that knows their niche, knows their target market, knows the vertical, and knows their customer persona that they go after. They're going to disqualify more ops than they qualify in that scenario, right? Because they have a very specific fit in the market. So depending on where you are in that sort of company maturity will really determine how you act in turn as a sales professional to qualify and disqualify your ops.
I think that's such a good point. And we have to keep in mind, right? The listeners of this sell in all different types of scenarios. So we've got startups, we've got all the way up to really established brands that anybody would know what they do. And it's not about getting our name out there. So I think it's a really important distinction that you raise. Let me ask you this. What do you think is the most common mechanism? And you can pick, let's do large enterprise because you're selling in large enterprise now. What do you think is the most common approach for prioritizing accounts? So I'm an AE, I get my territory in January, and I do what?
So, I mean, first off, you have to have some sort of level of prioritization on your accounts. Depending, are you managing existing accounts? Are you managing all white space or greenfield accounts, or is it a hybrid of the two? Regardless, you're going to assign a level of prioritization that first week or 2 weeks that you assume your territory. And you're going to look for things like total IT spend, total revenue, total organizational size, how many employees, right? Depending on what your product, depending on the product that you're selling, these quantitative metrics will determine how large the potential deal size will be with those specific customers. And that will help you prioritize your accounts. And what I like to use the ABCD model. So it's like your A prospects, your Bs, your Cs, but are all determined on organizational size, propensity to buy. Do they actually suffer from the problem your product is trying to solve, right? Depending on what you're selling, what sort of technology. But in terms of opportunity qualification, you really have these different methodologies or philosophies. And every sales rep comes across these. So internally, I see methodologies as MedPIC, Medic, BANT, right? These are all acronyms that leadership and management use to help them forecast and predict revenue. So they're looking at opportunities and they're trying to qualify them internally to say, hey, what is the probability of these deals coming in? Where should we align our resources to help support these across the finish line? But they help the sales professional identify what critical pieces of information are needed to progress the opportunity forward and the level of probability of those deals closing. But ultimately, MedPIC, BANT, Medic, whatever it is, like those aren't customer facing. You're not going to say, hey, Mr. Customer, here's my Medic acronym. Can you like fill in these blanks for me? Like, you know, it's just not going to happen. So those are more internal qualification and prioritization methodologies. There's a very simple one that I learned at Oracle that I thought was just genius in how simple it was, the three why buys. Why buy Oracle? Why buy anything? Why buy Oracle? Why buy now? And you can apply that to any product that you're selling, right? It's like, why is the customer looking to buy? Why is your product differentiated? And then what's the compelling event? Like super, super simple. And that's something you could actually propose to your customer, like, hey, why are you looking at this project? What's the ultimate problem? This is our differentiation. And then what's your compelling timeline, Mr. Customer? So that's a very simplified way to not only expose your customer to how you're qualifying and running the project, but making sure you're passing that, you know, information internally as well. And then we move to really the sales philosophies, which is where I think Challenger comes in. It's a way to help differentiate the salesperson in the sales pursuit while also bringing value to that sales process with every customer engagement. So you're differentiating yourself against the competition by providing a unique and differentiated sales experience, but you're also, quote unquote, pun intended, challenging the status quo. Your customers' assumptions about the industry, about the problem you're solving, about your product are being flipped on its head. You're bringing a unique and diversified perspective to these issues. And I don't see Challenger as a direct way to stack rank or prioritize your opportunities, but it's a way to help qualify that those are real opportunities, right? Are you getting the buying signals that you need to then bring the resources to the table to help support that opportunity pursuit with that particular customer, right?
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because I think I agree with largely everything you just said. The only thing I might be more curious about is, curious is my favorite word. I'm such a tool. I just love it. The thing I might be curious about is, I think last, or I don't know if it was 2 years ago when I was listening to the webinars before I was on this podcast, Mike Randazzo and John Shea, who were the hosts at the time, introduced this concept of reframe potential. Now, whenever I got a territory in January, I've always, for the last however many years I've been a hunter, I would always go through and say, like, who are all the big, sexy companies with big sales teams, right? That was my quality. Those were all my tier one or A level accounts.
Yeah.
And I would go after those companies all year long, regardless of what was going in the market. Now, you did say when you were describing your approach, you're sort of measuring to what extent do they face the problem that we solve. And I think that's the thing I messed up a lot. Like, I would look at a big medical device company. I talk about this one internally a lot. And I just think about the years I wasted going after this company with the wrong message. Because what I failed to appreciate is, just because they have a large sales force doesn't mean that they should be a customer of ours.
Right.
And I was never really thinking about the reframe that we have and how much potential that customer had to respond positively. So what I think I've learned, and I'm curious to kind of get your take on this, because I think I heard this in your response, is like, you still have to do the work with the demographics and find a company that in our case has one sales rep, or if you're selling something else, like they've got no patience or whatever the case may be. But at the same time, I think the thing I failed to consider a lot is if I'm going out and let's say I'm trying to sell to Zoom right now, and Zoom has 76% market share. Is there a reason for Zoom to change its sales motion? Like, they're not naturally going to say, yes, like, when can I buy this? And I think what I messed up a lot early was I failed to consider that in my prioritization. And I probably put them in the tier A just because they had a big sales team. But what do you think about that, right? You've worked on all different sizes of sales organizations.
Yeah, I'd give yourself a little more credit than you are. Some of the most creative, successful deals that I've seen done over the last decade were initially kicked off by a sales professional that created demand where none existed previously. So they called out a problem, they got in contact with the customer or the prospect, and they presented that customer with a unique perspective that identified a problem that they almost didn't know they had. And that's when the project got kicked off. And when you have those aha moments with customers and you're making that discovery together, that creates a very powerful trusted bond with the client, right? They may not even know what the root cause of their issue is. They may be over here saying, hey, this metric is declining. We don't know why, but we know this is an issue and we want to improve it. And really good sales reps have that genuine curiosity to keep peeling back the onion, asking the, you know, level one, level two, level three questions, open-ended questions. And that's what leads to you and the customer discovering the solution together, right? You want to lead with, not lead to. And that's ultimately, I think, what you were trying to do, looking at a medical device company that had massive potential, but maybe the way that you were approaching the value proposition wasn't resonating with them. It didn't mean that they were potentially not a good target. It just mean that maybe you need to approach it from a different attack vector.
I love the way you put that, because it's like, I can prioritize my opportunities, but I can't just assume that every company is going to have the same occasion for change or underlying problem. To me, I think what I love about the answer that you just gave is, I think of that as like, that's challenger when it works the best. You go in and you help that customer discover an issue. And I just love the way you articulated it, because the best thing about what you described is like, then I'm the person setting the demand. I'm the person setting the terms. I'm not like, sure, is it sometimes easier to meet with someone who's like, I know I have a problem, I'm shopping around for it? Sure. But sometimes they're farther ahead in their learning journey. And so the example you gave, like, chef's kiss to that. That's perfect. I love it. So let me switch gears a little bit. And let me ask you this. We don't talk about sales tech a lot on the podcast, but I do think opportunity prioritization is a space where there are emerging sales tech tools that are helpful. I'm curious, the answer to this could totally be, nope, I don't use them at all. But are there any sales technology tools that you use to help inform how you prioritize your accounts?
Definitely. We have a sales digital tech stack, as you would imagine, like most, if not all sales teams out there. We have the basics like CRM, right? We have the basics like digital email communication tracking and content management and allowing our reps to scale their communications effectively and to create multifaceted campaigns. But that's stacked with intelligence tools. So we have a database intelligence tool that will validate customer hierarchies, contacts, emails, and structures. So I'd say, I think the stats are like 87% accuracy, but I probably, as a user, I'd trim that down to probably about 78, 75. They tell you it's 87 or whatever, but in reality, it's impossible for them to keep it up to date with, obviously, with the attrition we're seeing in the marketplace overall. But intelligence tools are critical to give you that foundation, right? Are they a fit based on our product costs, our annual costs, and are they a fit based on the budgets they have, based on the data we can pull publicly? So that's like first cut. Second cut is an intelligence tool that tracks websites that allows you to see if your accounts are going on your competitors' websites or your accounts are going on your website and what keywords are they searching for. And then being able to aggregate that information and present it to your sales team on a weekly reporting basis. So they could, Monday morning, they get the report And that report tells them, hey, account ABC was on your competitor's website. They searched these keywords and they came on your website and they looked at these pages and these keywords and here's their email. That's the level of intelligence that we're dealing with now. So we have a database intelligence tool that validates contact information, location, data. Then we have an intelligence tool that's tracking customer movement in the public domain. Then we have an email communication tool that helps us automate and scale our digital communication to customers. And then we have our competitive intelligence tool that pulls in real time any content our competitors are publishing in terms of any competitive positioning, any new public pricing, any new products, and that's pulling it together and then comparing it against our own offering in real time as well. So if we know we're going up against competitor X in an account, we can log into that tool, pull the competitive intel down, and leverage it in the sales pursuit. I didn't use any names, but some of those are like ZoomInfo, DiscoverOrg, right? These are standard ones. Sixth Sense, which is the monitoring intelligence tool, SalesLoft, which is email communication management and outreach, and then Clue, which is the competitive intelligence tool. So there's lots out there.
There is. And I'm going to say this. I think that was the clearest answer I think I've gotten from a sales leader in a very long time about how they use their sales technology. It was just very, very clear. And I'm imagining if I'm a seller on your team, I know exactly what I'm using for what. But not to get too sidetracked this, but I am really curious because you do run a large enterprise sales team. Like, was that hard to get people to, we talk a lot about status quo, like unwind status quo of, I do all this manually and start using the technology to do it. Can you talk a little bit about how you worked with the team to get them comfortable?
Yeah. First and foremost, it's about gathering consent, collective consent. So right when we were going through this about 15 months ago, we were rebuilding the team and rebuilding our go-to-market. And with that came like, hey, what digital sales tools do we want? And that we're actually going to make use of. So there was some fundamental component. So I put it out to the team. I go, guys, what do you want to enable yourself to sell better, sell more effectively, and just be more efficient with your time? And so I collected that feedback. We hopped on a call. We talked about all the different technologies, the pros and cons of each. And then some guys opted out for some of the stuff. And so there was like a baseline set of digital sales tools that we brought and cascaded to the entire org. And then there was ones that we allowed them to opt in and out and just say, hey, I would make use of this or I wouldn't. And when you think about it, when you have, let's say, a hunter, right, that has 100 accounts, he needs to have tools in place to help him scale effectively. It's the only way he can handle managing 100 accounts at once. But if you are dealing with a large enterprise sales professional that has 5 accounts, he's not going to use email digital automation tool because every single one of his emails that he's sending is a personalized, very strategic email, and he's not blasting it out to hundreds of contacts. It's just so the nature of your role as a sales professional will then also dictate how you leverage or what tools you even want.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just thinking back to your backstory in sales. Can you imagine if you had sales technology back when you were going door to door at Xerox?
I had a printed binder of all my accounts. Everything was pen and paper. So I carried that around in my bag and I had like a pitch bag, and that's what I was downtown. So I was always walking around taking public transit, but yeah, it was all on paper.
That is so funny. I know it's like when I went to school, I walked through 2 miles of snow, but it's really one of those places. I think when you look at the job of selling today, like there's so many ways it got harder. But I love the way you described how you approach it, how you get the team's buy-in, how you think about different roles and responsibilities and use occasions for that. Because I think there's a whole discussion, we're not going to have it today, around like how and where and when to use sales tech. But to me, what you're describing sounds so smart and so helpful to the seller. It really sounds like you're putting the seller at the center. So it's very cool to hear that story.
The underlying theme here, and I think Challenger does such a great job at driving this home through different areas, is really, it boils down to the Socratic approach, right? I'm going to get a little philosophical, right?
Socrates, go there.
Right? Cooperative, argumentative dialogue. You're looking for that constructive tension, and it's about asking and answering questions to stimulate critical thinking, drawing out ideas and themes. That is the sole center of Challenger, and that was coined by Socrates, however many hundreds of years ago. But that's the approach I take as a leader as well, because the team brings a vast vast and differentiated perspectives and experiences across many different technologies that they've sold in their careers. And it's about aggregating that knowledge as a team and then sharing it amongst the group to improve our performance and our success rates. So we bringing it back to qualification, we may be pursuing an opportunity. When we highlight that opportunity on a team call, one of the other sales professionals on our team may put up their hand and say, stop what you're doing right now, and here's why. They may bring that unique differentiated perspective. And if you're not collaborating as a team, you just don't have the opportunity to share that knowledge.
I love that. And actually, so my next question for you, I think you already kind of teased your answer a little bit, was going to be like, when we look at when in Challenger studies, high performers and core performers, that like high performers have what we refer to as a nail shaped pipeline. So like big at the beginning and then immediately get skinny because they disqualify. And core performers have almost like a wedge. And it's like, we're waiting for those customers to opt out. So I think I know where we're going to go with the answer. I'm going to ask it anyway, because I just love your answers. How do you as a sales leader set the tone for your sales team around the importance of disqualifying early, but not too early?
It's a fantastic question. And I would answer it slightly differently in other roles that I've had. But for our specific role and for our specific team and the product that we sell and the vertical we sell it into, it's blaringly obvious when to disqualify opportunities out of the gate. Because we're in cybersecurity, we're in a very niche market. We're in the threat detection and response vertical, and we're really the Fortune 1000. So customers have very defined project processes, right? These big customers are like, hey, a project doesn't get started unless it follows A, B, C, D process and gets approval and budget assigned and executive sponsorship. A lot of that's already in place when you're selling at the Fortune 1000 level. So you're kind of lucky because it's already been pre-vetted on the client side. In the mid-market or smaller enterprise, sometimes you're doing that qualification on behalf of the customer. You're going to the executive saying, hey, are you sponsoring this project? Because I just met with your right-hand man in this division and he said this is the problem he's looking to solve. Have you assigned budget for that yet? A lot of that, you're doing the groundwork and the guerrilla tactics within accounts for those lower size or smaller enterprise pursuits. But in the Fortune 1000, a lot of that's been done. So when we engage with an opportunity or a prospect, very rarely are we disqualifying opportunities because it's been so vetted behind the scenes by the customer. But disqualifying opportunities is still obviously very important. The only difference is we have each one of my team members has a defined list of 30 accounts, right? So out of those 30, every single one fits within the Fortune 1000 band. There's always going to be projects on the go as they relate to cybersecurity, multiple throughout the year. So disqualifying isn't as critical for our team, but prioritization is where the criticality comes in, because you don't want to spin your wheels on projects that may be drawn out for years when you have an annual quota. So knowing how to prioritize opportunities based on a lot of the factors we discussed earlier is critical.
Love that. Okay. So let me throw a scenario at you. So let's say you have what you would deem to be the right opportunity, which sounds like it's pretty well defined in your space.
Yeah.
The seller gets on the call and it just feels like the wrong stakeholder. Maybe they've got the right title, but they don't present the characteristics of a mobilizer that we sort of talk about in Challenger. What do you advise your team to do in those instances, or do those instances even occur in your business?
They definitely do. And mixing up the titles and not getting to the right people, more often than not, we start with maybe not the strongest contact or not the right contact that's going to be driving the project forward. There's always that first form fit that you're looking for. Every opportunity starts with a cold intro call, right? An initial discovery. Is my understanding of why we're talking in line with your understanding of why we're talking? That's essentially what these intro calls, you know, start off as. And then they're followed by maybe a secondary deeper discovery session or a technical deep dive. And then that's followed by, okay, now we can do a demo, and then we move to proposal, and then pricing and closing, right? It's just a very simplified sales process. But within our business, and our product has a high degree of complexity. And with that comes an inherent outcome of a lot of different contacts within the customer site having to evaluate, validate, and sponsor the product through its through the evaluation. So on average, I say we deal with 8 to 10 different contacts within a within any opportunity that you're having to quarterback, aggregate, and challenge, frankly, obviously, on their perspectives and get them behind and to buy into your product. But that can be upwards of 15 to 20 contacts. So your first initial meeting, if you're meeting with one person, you can never be single-threaded. So if you need to pivot and ask them for a warm intro or sponsorship into another group or a warm email intro, as long as that conversation goes well and you build some credibility, you can pivot pretty easily within that account to additional contacts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did I answer your question there?
You absolutely did. No, and there's some ways I've definitely gotten that wrong in the past. And I think the advice that I now heed is, and actually Will Aitken, who is on our podcast last week, posted about this the other day, was saying like going above your prospect's head without having a candid conversation with them is a great way to get yourself in some trouble. And I can attest to that. I have done that. It did not pan out. So last question.
Sure.
This is a curveball. We ask this to everybody that comes on the show. If you could take anyone in sales out to lunch, living or dead, whether or not they are a VP of sales, I think we actually had someone say Socrates on a previous episode, who would it be and why?
That's a great question. My knee-jerk reaction says Grant Cardone.
Oh, why? Tell me why.
He's so in your face on social media all the time. Like when you're in sales, if you don't know who Grant Cardone is, you're not in sales, because like he's all over the map and he's so extreme. And I love understanding those extreme point of views. And I've listened to a few of his podcasts. He's been on Joe Rogan and whatever, but I find his perspectives. I'm curious about his perspectives and methodologies because he's so in your face and he's so open and just transparent about his process and about his tactics and about his lessons. He'll literally cold call clients for his attendees on conferences on speakerphone, and he'll literally put them on the spot and do it. And I think that's a very unique skill set that all salespeople inherently have to have, just not in front of a group of 300 people trying to negotiate. So I think, even though I think it's a little bit of a cheesy one, I honestly believe he knows what he's doing and he brings a unique perspective that maybe hasn't been leveraged in the enterprise selling space. He focuses more on public appeal and the public space, the masses. And there's something there. He's onto something, but how does that apply to the 12, 18 month, 24 month sales cycle in the large enterprise space? That's always just, I've always been curious to see how those methodologies would be applicable.
I've yet to be disappointed by an answer to this question with one of our guests. I love that answer. What's the saying? Like, fortune favors the bold. Like, you absolutely have to sit back and admire that that is one of the boldest dudes out there in sales. I completely agree with you. I did see, do you follow Corporate Bro?
Of course.
Yeah. Did you see the video he did about Grant the other day? It was a couple weeks.
I didn't. Funny enough, Corporate Bro, I started following him when he was way back when he was like unknown. He was like an intern. I think he was, before he joined Oracle, I think he was working at Salesforce and then he went to Oracle and whatever. But it was just like a side hustle. And I remember he got sued by the Comedy Network over branding because he was Corporate Bro and they came out with a show called Corporate, which was basically a copy of what he was doing. Anyways, that it ended up, but he was, no one knew who he was back then. And he was hilarious. He was putting out just hilarious content on Instagram. And now he's blown up. He does speaking engagements and he does corporate events. And like, I'm so happy for the guy because he hustled to build that brand reputation. And if he does an episode or a skit on Grant, I'm going to have to watch it.
I'm going to send you the link. It was hilarious because I watched Corporate Bro's interpretation and then I went back and watched Grant's. And it was just funny. And I love how like Corporate Bro just lightens it. He's not knocking Grant Cardone. He's not taking away anything from it. But it just, you made me think of it when you gave that answer. So I'll send it to you so you can watch it because you'll laugh. Awesome. Awesome. So I know we're at time. We actually went a little bit over, but I can't thank you enough. It is so refreshing to hear from a sales leader who really embraces a lot of these principles, is so thoughtful about why you do what you do. I will say, I think anyone who works for you, I think is very, very lucky. And I've just really enjoyed the time getting to know you a little bit better and learn how you think about this topic and some other topics we covered. So again, thank you so much for being with us today. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in again.
Likewise, Jen, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, as always, for joining us here on Winning the Challenger Sale. For the tools and resources you need to close more deals, head over to challengerinc.com.